Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, District Attorney Deborah Gonzalez joins us to talk about new initiatives in her office and more.
We've been able to, number one, build a great team, and number two, start in those initiatives that I had laid out in my platform.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, how physical activity may help control burnout among healthcare workers.
They are fatigued, and we have to be thoughtful about how this new variant is affecting them.
Plus, our panel on rising COVID cases and the weekend news and politics.
On Tuesday, they're going to bring something forward to require Athens-Clarke County employees to be vaccinated.
Those stories, plus a preview of what's going on at the Georgia Museum of Art. That's coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia, Sao Paulo,
Beirut, London.
Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. When Deborah Gonzalez was elected district attorney last year, she was a trailblazer in many ways. The first Hispanic district attorney in Georgia, the first female DA in the Western Judicial Circuit, and the first Puerto Rican woman to be elected as DA in the country. But her first few months in office haven't been without controversy. Not long after her election, some in Oconee County wanted to separate their county from the Western Judicial Circuit, which Gonzalez serves. And earlier this month, Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr singled out Gonzalez in a House committee hearing, criticizing her for declining to prosecute some low-level offenses. Deborah Gonzalez joins me here today for Athens News Matters to discuss these items and other issues. So thank you so much for spending some time with us, DA Gonzalez.
Thank you, Alexia. So glad to be here with you.
You ran for DA on a platform of change in the way your office does its job. What major developments are you most proud of so far?
That we are sticking to exactly what I had run on. You know, we've already secured our first major partnership and grant with the Vera Institute of Justice. Another initiative is our data dashboard. And so we are actually putting final touches on our website. This is the first time that individuals in our judicial circuit will be able to look right online and get real-time information and statistics about what is going on in our jails and in the DA's office.
Sort of big initiatives.
They are. And some of them, like the data dashboard, we didn't think we were going to get to at least year two or three.
It's never a bad thing to be ahead of schedule.
No, it's not.
In recent news, Columbia County is separating from the Augusta Judicial Circuit. Locally, there have been some conversations of Oconee County leaving the Western Judicial Circuit. What's the likelihood of that even happening here, Deborah?
So we did discover that Representatives Houston Gaines and Marcus Wiedauer actually did put in a request to the Judicial Council to find out about whether Oconee could secede. And as most of us know, they just don't have the numbers. And it would be extremely expensive. The Columbia Circuit is costing the state and the taxpayers $1.4 million just to make that happen. And so what occurred was that the Judicial Review Council looked at that, looked at some other requests that had come to it, and decided that the only viable solution, they looked at about 14 different scenarios, was actually merging the Western Judicial Circuit with the Alcove Circuit, which consists of Walton and Newton counties, two metro Atlanta counties. And that's when I said, oh, wait a minute. Because what that would do is basically take any kind of autonomy from Athens and Oconee residents and make us sort of now under the authority of two Metro Atlanta counties because of their population. I mean, they have over 200,000 people, and so any time an election would come, it would be their candidates who would be winning, and we wouldn't have a judge anymore from Athens. We wouldn't have a DA from Athens or Nocone.
It also impact our local judges on the bench, correct? How would that
That's work? Right, because if they merged, one, first of all, there isn't a mechanism to just fire a DA. Right? I'm a constitutionally elected officer. But two, it would mean that the judges would have to travel the entire circuit, right? Now, I do want to clarify that the Judicial Council did not recommend the merger, but I do want to also point out that they didn't recommend the split for Columbia either, and yet the legislatures went ahead and did that.
And making it much more complicated than what it seems to be right now.
Yeah, I mean, and also when you think about if this is a reaction to a result in an election that you don't like, we have a democratic process. But this idea of being able to gerrymander a judicial circuit, and we are already concerned about the gerrymandering of our districts and of our commission districts as well on the local level. And that is something that is set to take place in the special session that the legislatures are going to have this fall.
Also, we have heard from Attorney General Chris Carr, the state attorney general, who claims that you are prosecuting certain crimes but not others.
There are some who have decided to pick and choose which laws they want to enforce.
Is there anything you'd like to say to our listeners in response to this claim?
I often say, well, if somebody's not pissed, I'm not doing my job right? Because I did say I was going to bring change. Here it is. But what he was talking about were these very low-level misdemeanor type of crimes. And I have, you know, been very vocal about the limited resources that we have. And so what I've done with my office is really focus on the most violent crimes, the true hardcore felonies of murder, aggravated assault, sexual assault, child molestation, drug trafficking, which is very different from the simple possession that he sort of pointed out. And when you have limited resources, when you are coming out of a pandemic that has basically brought us a backlog of over a year, I have to be very efficient and effective as to where I put my people's focus on. And, you know, I'm really proud. Did you know that Athens and Oconee, our Western Judicial Circuit, was one of the first ones to start jury trials? We still have major, large counties that still have not done a single jury trial. We've been doing them since mid-March.
So you are really quite busy in the district attorney's office.
Yes, we are.
I just would like to thank you once again for spending some time with us. I know you have a full plate, but I do appreciate your stopping by our studio and giving us some time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend.
Deborah Gonzalez is the district attorney for the Western Judicial Circuit. We spoke earlier this week.
A new Georgia law gives a chance for thousands of Georgians on felony probation to end their probation sentence early. That also means they'll be able to vote again. But advocates say the challenge now is letting people know they even qualify. GPB's Riley Bunch reports.
Frances Jones of Macon spent 2 years in prison for shoplifting and forgery. She calls those lost years for a lot of reasons.
I finally got out, but in that process, I lost my kids. So not only did I lose 2 years of my life, but I also lost custody of all of my kids.
And she lost the ability to vote, even after being released on more than a decade of probation, which didn't sit well with her.
We have to get out of this mentality that voting is a privilege. Voting is not a privilege. It is a right. You're born in the United States. You have a right to vote.
This year, Georgia lawmakers from both sides of the aisle agreed that people like Jones should have a faster path to rolling off of probation and passed a law that allowed her to lop 4 years off of her sentence. It also restored her ability to vote. Jones is just one of hundreds of thousands of Georgians serving a probation or parole sentence that keeps them from participating in elections. That's more people per capita than any other state in the country, one in 18 residents, more than three times the national average. Advocates say that's because probation in Georgia can last a long time. Nearly half of all Georgia's probation sentences exceed 10 years. Atiyah Hawley, attorney for the Southern Center for Human Rights, says that sets up a vicious cycle.
It just keeps people in this revolving door of correctional control in jail that they just don't need to be in.
The new law makes an early end of probation possible if someone has already completed 3 years of their sentence, has paid all their restitution, and if they have avoided probation violations. About 48,000 people may qualify in the state. And Hawley says that's a lot of potential voters in a time when elections have been won by just a few votes.
And, you know, we're not talking about 10 people. We're not talking about a small group of people. We are talking about, again, hundreds of thousands of people who are stripped of their right to vote because of probation.
And this is a population that is also disproportionately people of color. Frances Jones is white. Even so, she saw inequity during her time in the criminal justice system.
People need to start pointing this out, that we recognize this is a form of racism. There is systematic racism in this country. I've seen it firsthand.
Criminal justice lobbyists have fought for years to change Georgia's felon disenfranchisement laws before getting probation reform legislation across the finish line. Rachel Holmes is a managing attorney with the Georgia Justice Project. She gives some of the credit to the protests for Black Lives last summer.
Black individuals are twice as more likely to be on probation and eight times more likely in certain counties. So that is just something that people are starting to reckon with and starting to understand of what being under correctional control, being in the criminal justice system, what that does.
The challenge now? To reach tens of thousands of Georgians who qualify to end their probation early. Groups like the Georgia Justice Project are holding webinars and spreading the word at voter mobilization events. For GPB News, I'm Riley Bunch.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
Earlier this week, Savannah became the first major city in Georgia to reimpose a mask mandate, followed closely by Atlanta. Both mandates aren't quite as far-reaching as previous ones, with Savannah only requiring masks in city buildings and businesses with especially vulnerable populations, such as hospitals and child care centers. Atlanta went a step further, requiring them in indoor public places like stores and restaurants. Following Savannah's decision, Mayor Kelly Gertz initially said that there was no immediate plan to reissue a mask mandate here, but the commission could vote to do so in the future. Here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Blake Odd of Flagpole, Chris Dowd of Athens Politics Nerd, and Gwen O'Looney of WXAG. So welcome back, everyone, and let's just get your take on this. How likely do you think we are to see Athens reinstitute a mask mandate of our own in the near future?
I think they probably will. I'm not sure. There's been a lot of confusion about this. The mask ordinance had a sunset provision that it was no longer in effect when Athens dropped below 100 cases per 100,000 people over the past 14 days. And that's a pretty common metric that's used to measure the spread of COVID in the community. So we've been below that threshold since back in May. So the mask ordinance has not been being enforced. And even some of the commissioners thought that now that we're back above 100 again, we were at around 128 or 129 the last time I checked. Even some of the commissioners were under the impression that it would kick back in, but the mayor told me that it doesn't automatically kick back in. So the commission, I think there would be some appetite to probably bring it back, but the commission is going to have to take action on that to do so. I do know that on Tuesday that they're going to bring something forward to require Athens-Clarke County employees to be vaccinated. That's going to be on the agenda on Tuesday, but I haven't heard anything for sure about the mask mandate being put on the agenda for the voting meeting on Tuesday.
I think that that they probably will follow the trends across the country in most progressive places.
Yeah, we really need to institute this mask mandate again. The numbers are going in the wrong direction. I mean, I'm so tired of talking about this. I'm so tired of worrying about this, but it's the right thing to do. We have to do what we can to stop this disease. It's a deadly disease, and it's not gone. It's coming back. We have to do whatever we can do to stop it.
Yeah, this really reminds me of last summer. The trends look an awful lot like they looked when the governor started lifting a lot of COVID restrictions back in June of 2020. And we all know what happened after that. We had a huge spike. We had a spike in June, and then it kind of plateaued. And then we had another huge spike when the students came back in August. We were at that point in the top 10 of all the counties in the country in terms of COVID cases per capita. And we're going in that direction again. And this Delta variant is much, much more contagious than the original virus. And anyone who's unvaccinated is really putting themselves at risk of serious illness. The hospitals are filling up again. And that means that even if you are vaccinated, if you have another kind of health issue, you're going to have a hard time getting admitted. So it's a problem for everyone. And the longer this goes on, the more likely that some sort of mutation is going to arise that the vaccines are not going to be effective on.
We've got football getting ready to happen. You know, August is students back. Athens doesn't have a choice.
We need the university to show some leadership here too. What we're seeing with Delta is more serious for young people. And we're seeing a lot of 20-something people show up in the hospital now because of Delta. So the university really needs to step up here, I think.
They have to follow, though, the USG guidelines, right? They can't act unilaterally. They can't be tougher than what USG puts in place.
They can't require it, and I think they should require it, but the USG has said they're not going to require it. And I know that UGA has no authority to go against that, but they need to do whatever they can. It's very important for them to do anything that's within their power to do to encourage students to get vaccinated.
I completely agree. Like, we need to see some leadership here. This is important.
Let's switch gears here. The commission is getting closer to passing its anti-discrimination ordinance, which I understand has been in the works for a long time. Chris, do you want to fill us in on the history of this effort and tell us where we are now?
Right. Yeah. So you might remember the protest in 2016 against the bar downtown, General Beauregard's. It's a Confederate theme, and word has it they were serving a drink with their racist name. And there were protests, like hundreds of people got out in the streets protesting. And this is how the Athens anti-discrimination movement was born, actually. And so at that time, AADM had two major demands. And so the first one was a human rights committee that would hear discrimination complaints. And then the second was an anti-discrimination ordinance that would be enforceable. And so they could hold the violators accountable. And so the Human Rights Committee is still being worked on, but the anti-discrimination ordinance is actually complete, and the commission is going to vote on that next week, and I believe that's going to pass. So this is all very exciting to me.
Georgia is one of only 20 states in our nation that have no state anti-discrimination law, and that means that people have to make any complaints, file complaints with the feds, which is a long and expensive process, very sophisticated and discouraging to most of the people that are discriminated against. So I think that this gives us an excellent opportunity. It'll be interesting to see how realistic the implementation is, as the $1,000 fine that can only be applied three times before the person loses their business license. Of course,
This does not apply to state agencies. This is only related to local agencies and not to private clubs like the country club, not to religious institutions, the normal things that anti-discrimination laws are modeled after.
Yeah, this one was modeled in particular after one in Brookhaven, I believe, that has withstood some legal scrutiny. So it seems like it's on pretty solid ground. But I mean, Gwen's right. It's not probably not as far reaching as some would like. And the real question is, it sounds like it's got some teeth in it. You know, if you're a repeat offender, you can lose your business. That's a pretty serious penalty. But you know, what kind of resources are going to be put into enforcing it is really kind of the question.
Yeah, I agree. So it will, you know, prevent discrimination, from a long list of things, you know, race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, a bunch of things. And it will prevent discrimination in employment, employment benefits, public accommodations, and housing. But there are some things that it doesn't cover. So they weren't able to put protections for immigration status, like undocumented immigrants, like that had to be left out because there's just no legal protection for that, unfortunately. And something else that was kind of big that they had to leave out was for hairstyles, even though to me, this definitely should fit under racial discrimination if you're, you know, refusing to hire someone if they have dreadlocks, for example. But there's been a recent federal court case that's upheld the right of employers to discriminate against people and refuse to hire them if they have dreadlocks. So because that was so recent and so specific, they didn't put in any protections for hairstyles in there. They just thought it wouldn't hold up.
And finally, before we go, the deadline to submit a proposal for T-SPLOS projects is coming up August 15th. I want to ask each of you, what would you like to see passed?
Well, I love the emphasis that I believe will happen on public transportation. And I hope that we will really do a better job of making biking safe throughout our community. We're trying, but we haven't gotten there.
Yeah, I would love to see support for fare free transit to have like a continuing support for that in T-SPLOST. And also, you know, completing the Firefly Trail, I think would be great. And just sidewalks and bike lanes in general.
Yeah, I agree with all those things. I think we should do a green T-SPLOST. If it were up to me, I would not want to see any money spent on roads. I would want all of it spent on completing the bike lane network, completing the sidewalk network, and especially more convenient, more frequent transit, things like bus rapid transit, which is sort of like light rail on wheels, where you have regular service, you have platforms, you could pre-buy your tickets. You know, I could see something like that on Atlanta Highway or Prince Avenue, you know, almost like a trolley system, but cheaper. So those are some of the things that I'd like to look at.
You just heard from Gwen O'Looney with WXAG, Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd, and Blake Odd with Flagpole.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. According to a 2020 report from America's Health Rankings, Georgia ranks 28th in the nation for adult obesity. Obesity is associated with diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and a host of other negative health outcomes. However, for older adults, maintaining a healthy weight is especially important to prevent chronic disease and physical disability. Dr. Ellen Evans is the Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Education at the Mary Frances Early College of Education. She is also the author of a recently published paper on the impacts of high-protein diets and exercise on weight loss in older women. She joins us today to talk about her research. To start, could you give us a brief overview of the goals and design of your study?
Sure. We had three different groups that were given three different treatments. And the goal was to really see the relative effectiveness of the three treatments on our outcomes of interest. And so the treatments were a higher protein diet with exercise, a normal conventional controlled carbohydrate diet, if you will, in exercise, or a higher protein diet with no exercise. And we compared the effectiveness of the treatments in the older women on outcomes of interest, such as body composition, how much fat mass did they lose or change, how much muscle mass did they lose. And also we looked at physical function, their ability to do tasks such as up and down on a chair and walking 6 minutes and things like that.
What were some of your key takeaways for overweight or obese older women?
Well, we thought we were going to find, we hypothesized that the higher protein and exercise group would be the best group. What we actually found was all three groups lost about the same amount of weight, and that the protein treatment really didn't have much effect. What was really, really apparent is it highlighted the importance of exercise during weight loss for older women.
In your study, you measured how protein-rich diets and exercise impact lower extremity physical function. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and why maintaining it is important to a person's mental and social well-being?
Absolutely. So lower extremity physical function allows you to maintain your independence. So things such as going up and down stairs, do your own toileting and your bathing, things like that. Most older adults are not interested in necessarily living somewhere else. They want to stay in their home and take care of themselves. And to be able to do that, you have to be able to walk and move and take care of your tasks.
What are some of the dangers and risks of losing weight too quickly?
We do know that when people lose weight very quickly, they tend to not keep that weight off, which is usually a goal. People want to lose their weight and maintain their weight loss. Losing weight very quickly also can result in greater loss of muscle mass. So a nice gradual weight loss of 1 to 2 pounds, you know, as a week goes along, lower is actually better.
What are some ways researchers and health providers can help older women overcome these challenges?
I would say in terms of the overweight older adult, especially, if they're going to embark on a pretty serious weight loss protocol, they should check in with their physician because folks have lots of different things that often go on with health. They may be on medications, for example, that when they start losing weight, now they may be in a relative over-medicated state. We also realize that, especially when it comes to eating, that there's a lot of misinformation out there, and especially with protein. Understanding protein and protein grams and where you get your protein and how to do all that is challenging. On the exercise side, especially with strength training, everybody wants to know what to do, how to do it, so that they have the benefits without hurting themselves. So then when we know what to do, then it all becomes about behavioral management. And we're going to have to manage our behaviors in a world that does not encourage that at every turn. And most people to do that need a lot of social support. Support in the home, they need it from the friends. And I think that's the kind of the next frontier is how do we manage our behaviors.
Dr. Ellen Evans is the Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Education in the Mary Frances Early College of Education. Once again, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Climate change and limited water resources are taking a toll on the habitat of endangered plants, but Georgia conservationists are taking a fresh approach to the problem. From our colleagues at Georgia Public Broadcasting, Grant Blankenship reports.
The brambles are thigh high as researchers explore territory about 50 miles north of the Florida Panhandle.
So we're going to walk into a forested wetland that has a lot of tupelo.
Lisa Genke is a plant ecologist here at the Jones Center at Itchway. She leads this team through what was a hunting preserve owned by the Woodruff family of Coca-Cola fame. Now it's owned by the Charitable Woodruff Foundation. In this group are scientists from the Georgia Department of Natural Resources and private landowners. They're looking for an endangered plant called the pondberry. We found the female plants.
Starts here and goes to like the tall sweet gum over there.
They might be clones of each other, really just one plant. That's because genetic reproduction requires male plants, and those are somewhere on the other side of the wetland. That's why pondberry is one of 14 federally endangered plants in Georgia. Today's Nature Walk has an important goal: to collect seeds, sock away those seeds in seed banks, and hopefully one day in the future, put plants back on the landscape. Some call that rewilding. It's not new work, but there will be more projects like this through the help of a five-year, $780,000 federal grant to Georgia DNR. The aim today is to find this relative of sassafras. It's about 4 feet tall with fuzzy leaves, zigzag stems, and today, lots of tiny, unripe green fruit. There shouldn't be seeds to collect for months. But then DNR botanist Carly Stepp sees something really cool.
There's red fruit.
Already?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why?
There's one red, ripe fruit. And that means there's a seed. And so a debate ensues. Collect the seed or not? Lisa Genke says this is the only spot on Itchaway they've seen pondberry.
Mm-hmm. So we just take one tornado or one hurricane, and this population could be gone.
The debate's tabled to look for that stand of male plants across the water. That's where retired science teacher and timberland owner Heather Brazel whips out a tiny magnifying glass to see the details in a pondberry stem.
This has got the entire
leaf.
Margin. About 70% of the woodland in Georgia is privately owned. Much of that's monocropped in pine tree plantations. So Brazel says private landowners, even people with just a patch of garden, need to make space for rare plants.
So the idea is that little areas can collectively become significant in terms of conservation and mm-hmm. habitat.
An important part of this project is determining where to plant the seeds they collect. DNR senior botanist Lisa Cruz says that's just one step in the process.
We're not to the point where we have a notion of where that would be at this point. More now, it's more just protecting the genetic resources.
Can you grab one of those trees? Back at the female pondberry.
Is it red enough?
They check the berry again. They need to decide whether to take it or leave it.
I think it's red enough, yeah.
Cruz delicately plucks slips it in an envelope.
This is like the famous fruit right now.
And then someone asks, hey, is this the first seed of this project?
Yes.
That's exciting.
One precious seed. Hopefully the first of many. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Baker County.
The last 17 months have been grueling for healthcare workers, and burnout is an increasing worry. A new study says that more physical activity could be crucial to managing the stress that healthcare workers face. Dr. Marilyn Wolf is an alumna of UGA's College of Public Health and the lead author of that study. Welcome, Dr. Wolf.
Hi, Alexia. Thanks so much for having me.
So to start, can you tell us more about your research and how you came to this conclusion?
So this was a study that I conducted during my dissertation research with Dr. Jennifer Gay, my colleagues, Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Wilson. We noticed that in the literature, there's less information about the types of physical activity associated with stress and burnout, as well as well-being. And so I decided to look at different types of physical activity that may be associated with those outcomes. And so occupational physical activity is the physical activity you do at your work or on your work time, and physical activity you do for fun. So different types of hobbies, if you like to go running, jogging, those kinds of activities. We're pretty much interested in a subset of our population. So healthcare industry workers was our main population that we wanted to look at, given that those are psychological outcomes, burnout and well-being that go with that typical population. So we looked at those different associations, and we found that leisure time, physical activity was mitigated the effects of burnout and stress. And unfortunately, we saw an association where occupational physical activity, we found a positive association. So with more of occupational physical activity, we saw an increase in stress and exhaustion.
We're seeing that COVID cases are starting to rise once again because of the Delta variant. How do you think this will negatively affect healthcare workers?
I think healthcare workers are absolutely, they're on the front line again, and they have always been, and we are so grateful for their, for what they do, and they come in day to day. They are tired and they are fatigued, and we have to be thoughtful about how this new variant is affecting them. So what I would say is that the effects of that Delta variant on the healthcare population is that we have to continue to be thoughtful about, you know, how to mitigate those COVID effects. We have seen the science and what is being played out with the Delta variant now, that we have to be very cautious still about mitigating the effects, washing our hands frequently. But I do believe that, you know, healthcare workers, again, are maybe seeing an increase and just have to really take care of themselves amongst this increase, and physical activity is one way to do so.
What do you think should be done to make sure healthcare workers are cared for in the future?
I strongly believe that the workplace really has an opportunity here to give access to more physical activity and self-care types of benefits to healthcare workers. I know that some workplaces don't have physical activity benefits in place or interventions in place for their healthcare workers. And so I do believe it's the workplace that can help support physical activity, as well as even the supervisors helping to support physical activity and self-care for their workers so that they can mitigate those effects and those psychological outcomes that come from burnout and stress and exhaustion. We have an ambitious population of workers doing this wonderful work, but I strongly believe that they have to recognize those warning signs of stress and exhaustion, because it is a cycle. Once you're in it, it's hard to come out of it. And so taking steps to become more aware, to take care of themselves and to recognize those warning signs that start to come and show, I think is really something the worker should recognize, and workplace interventions should also recognize to help support those healthcare workers. So it's a two-way street, really recognizing from an individual standpoint the need for self-care, but also the workplace to help really support their workers.
Dr. Marilyn Wolf is an alumna of UGA's College of Public Health and the lead author of the study on physical activity benefiting healthcare workers. Once again, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Alexia.
My name is Pamela Coe. I am the executive director of Cine, Athens' only nonprofit cinema and event space that builds community through art and culture. We highly recommend WGA underwriting to any business or organization that strives for excellence, listens local, and aspires to engage our diverse Athens community in meaningful discourse, dialogue, and lively conversation. Find out how you can become an underwriter by emailing wuga@uga.edu.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. The Georgia Museum of Art has been open to guests since August of 2020. But as we'll hear next, the museum has a great variety of exhibits on display this summer. WUGA's Kathy Bradbury spoke with Hillary Brown, the Director of Communications with the Georgia Museum of Art. Here's their conversation.
There's a huge variety of shows. One in particular that was just really exciting to me is The Crime of Art. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It was organized by Site Santa Fe in collaboration with the Mead Art Museum, and it's traveled to several other museums. The artist, Kota Izawa, is very interested in theft. And most of the works in this show focus on the heist from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston in 1990, when thieves entered disguised as police officers. They tied up the guards. They took 13 objects and disappeared with them, and nobody has found them since then. It continues to be a major investigation by the FBI. There's a documentary on Netflix right now about it, which is great timing for us. So Kota has done sort of simplified digital versions of the works that were stolen. It is a really beautiful show. Also, the galleries are super dark, so you have these like glowing light boxes with these cool contemporary images in them.
So you've got that going on in one gallery. Right next door, Neo Abstraction, celebrating a gift of contemporary art from John and Sarah Schlesinger. I love abstraction, and the pieces in this particular gallery, scale-wise, they're just huge.
They are. It's a really special show. So the curator who put this together, that's our curator of American art, Jeffrey Richmond Mall, is focusing on the idea of artists working in abstraction, but in a different way. Like a lot of these artists, the way that they achieve abstraction is through taking the human element out of their work or by minimizing it. Damien Hirst, who has, it's one of the first works that the Schlesingers acquired, is one of his spin paintings. And you've probably done this with your children, where you take a canvas and you put in a little thing that spins and you squirt paint on it. So he used that same process, just on a larger scale. But the point is, there's chance, there's randomness. It's not just all the artist's decision as far as what the work ends up looking like. There's also photography in there by Matthew Brandt, who takes pictures of bodies of water, and then he submerses the negatives in water from that thing that he took a picture of and leaves it there for a while. So it corrodes. It gets, you know, things on the film that weren't there in the original photograph that he can't control. It's a natural process. And the results are really interesting. They're abstracted and they're beautiful and they talk about environmentalism and all kinds of things. So that's sort of what this show is about, is the different forms that abstraction is taking in contemporary art. It's interesting to have this next to the Kota Izawa show because that one is so dark and this gallery is so light. They make really interesting pairing.
And then we move right along into the next gallery, into Hands and Earth, Perspectives on Japanese Contemporary Ceramics, which, again, amazing collection.
That collection belongs to Carol and Jeffrey Horvitz. So this is another traveling show that we did not assemble. We have another show of works from their collection down the hallway in the permanent collection wing, contemporary Japanese ceramics from the Horvitz collection, which is smaller. This one is much more galleries, and it shows a wide variety of Japanese ceramics.
A couple of the pieces in this particular collection, it's sort of like a collection of jars, and it goes from, you know, a standard jar all the way down to the teeniest, tiniest little piece of ceramics. But it's amazing to see the scale laid out that way.
That work really does hold your attention. I mean, the smallest one is like it's smaller than your pinky fingernail. It's so tiny, and it's still just as perfect as the large one. To me, that's one of the things that's important about going to museums in person. You can look at the pictures over and over again, and you can still not understand how big or small something is until you're in a room with it looking at it. And this show is really fantastic for that.
We also have Rediscovering the Art of Victoria Hudson Huntley, which is lithography. Tell the listener what lithography means.
How it works? Well, yeah. Litho means stone. So what it involves is drawing on a stone, that's like an actual big, heavy piece of stone, the image that you want, except you have to draw it in reverse because you're going to print it. So you got to think backwards. And then you draw on it with sort of a greasy crayon, basically. Then you apply a substance that slightly eats away everything that's not that waxy, greasy crayon. And then you ink it. The ink goes into the crevices that were eaten away and you print it. It's very difficult. In some ways, it's one of the most difficult forms of printmaking because the stones are so heavy. Huntley is interesting. She was working in, you know, the 30s through the 50s. She printed the stones herself frequently. Not everybody who's a printmaker does the actual printmaking themselves, but she did. And she wrote a lot about how these stones were heavy and how it was hard on her physically to do it. And we have some great photographs of her with the actual stones. She got a grant at one point to go out into the Everglades, and there are a lot of prints from that era when she made drawings of all these birds in flight and then turned those into prints. So they're sort of like spooky and natural and Floridian, and they have a lot of atmosphere to them.
So all of those great exhibits are up currently at the Georgia Museum of Art. Through most of the summer, you can see them, but I encourage you to go.
Please do sign up for a time ticket before you come. You can do it at georgiamuseum.org. Just click on the Visit tab on our website, or there's a link right on the main page where you can get your tickets. You can get them as a walk-up if you forget, but it will send you a reminder if you do it in advance. If you want to keep up with everything that's going on at the museum all the time, you can become a friend of the museum for absolutely free at jointhemuseum.com. You just put in your name and your email address, and you will get a weekly email with everything that we have going on, exhibitions, programming, etc. So we would encourage everybody to do that.
Hillary Brown is Communications Director for the Georgia Museum of Art, and we should note that the museum is a financial supporter of WUGA.
Finally today, an update on a story we brought you a few weeks ago. You may remember meeting Rodney Walters, Athens-Clarke County's Community Forestry Coordinator. We talked to Rodney about the ongoing community tree study.
This is a statistical quantification of trees in Athens-Clarke County. Involving both public and private trees.
And remember, trees are a big deal in Athens-Clarke County, which has, according to the ACC Sustainability Office, more tree canopy than any other city of over 100,000 people in the U.S.
Earlier this week in the ACC Manager's Snapshot, County Manager Blaine Williams noted that the data collection phase of the study is roaring along, with data for about 75% of the 228 plots already collected.
The data is being collected by UGA students, and they're well ahead of schedule, which means that more data plots may be added, giving foresters a clearer picture of the types, health, and numbers of the county's trees.
And if you want to learn more about the Community Tree Study, check out our interview with Rodney Walters, or head over to the Athens-Clarke County YouTube page, where you can find short videos about the benefits of trees to the county and what to expect from the tree study.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Jean Davis, Jessica Wurst, Lucas Trevor, Devin Zwald, and Sarah Train. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
If you missed one of the stories on this week's broadcast, or you just want to listen again to some of our previous reporting and interviews, head over to WUGA.org to find all of our work online. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. As always, thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and stay with WUGA for local, state, national, and global news throughout the week.